Look at me, I'm becoming a Metzky. I wanted a wedding like Betty's, small, quick, and simple, but that wasn't in the cards. For one thing, there was no rabbi's office big enough for all of Aaron's relatives, so small was out. Maybe we could keep it simple, but it wasn't going to happen quickly, because Jake's bar mitzvah was coming up in October, and Betty was already up to her eyeballs getting ready for that. Bar mitzvahs weren't the productions they are today, with caterers and hotels and flowers, but they were still a big deal, and Betty wanted it perfect. She tried out I don't know how many recipes for strudel and cookies, painted the dining room, and made new curtains for the living room. Everyone got new clothes, and Levine took Jake downtown to buy him his first grown-up suit with long pants and a vest. Like I said, a big deal. On the morning of the bar mitzvah, my mother got up on the wrong side of the bed. Usually she was the first one up, drinking her tea, washing her cup, and putting it away before my father and I even got to the kitchen, but on that day of all days, she didn't even have her shoes on when it was time to go. When I asked if she was feeling all right, she answered like I had insulted her. "When am I ever sick?" By the time we got to the synagogue, which was only 3 blocks away, she was practically shuffling and holding on to my arm. She closed her eyes when we sat down in the synagogue, and I was sure she was asleep. But when my father was called up to sing the blessings, she sat straight. And when Jake chanted his portion from the Torah, she was smiling. "Wasn't he wonderful?" I whispered. "Not bad," she said. Jake still looked like a chubby little boy, but he did a wonderful job. He didn't stumble or slow down, and he chanted everything loud and clear. I was so proud of him, I had tears in my eyes, but Betty just about collapsed from the nachas. You'll understand nachas when you have children. There's nothing like the feeling you have when your child stands in front of a crowd and shines. It was like that when your mother made the speech at her high school graduation, and how I felt at your bat mitzvah and your sister's. After the service, everyone went downstairs for sponge cake and wine. My mother was not the old lady I had helped down the street anymore. She moved fast enough to avoid most of the Metzky hugs, and when someone asked if she was proud of her grandson, she said, "Of course, what do you think?" For once, she didn't mention that Jake wasn't really her grandson. Aaron and I took our time getting to the party at Betty's house. It was one of those perfect fall days when the air is cool enough to wake you up, but the sun is also kissing your face. Aaron kicked around in the leaves, and I made a bouquet out of red and gold ones. We were like a couple of kids. It felt wonderful to be alone, and we had a lot to talk about. Someone at the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children had heard Aaron move to Boston and offered him a job, but his brother was trying to talk him into staying at his firm. Michael said if he stayed put, we could buy our own house in a year or two. Aaron had been working in Michael's office since he got back to Boston, but he hated it. Writing contracts and arguing with bankers made him grumpy and grouchy like I'd never seen him. But after one meeting with the Children's Society Committee, he was glowing. "These are the same people who started the National Child Welfare Committee," he said. They were his heroes, and they wanted to hire him to help the governor's office make better laws to help children and families. It was a dream job, and I knew that the only reason he didn't say yes on the spot was because they couldn't pay him the kind of money he was making in private practice. But I said, "What good is a house if I have to live in it with a crab?" It wasn't hard to talk him into doing what he wanted. Besides, I was working too. Gussie, God bless her, had found me a full-time job at Simmons. The minute she heard that the vice president's secretary was leaving, she called him and said not to bother looking for a replacement. Betty joked that I got my wish. I was finally going to college. But it wasn't a joke, because I could take classes after work for free. Once we decided that Aaron was going to take the job he wanted, he couldn't wait to get back and tell the families that we were setting a date for our wedding. It couldn't be soon enough for me. Every time I walked into my parents' house, I felt like I was putting on a corset. Betty's place was mobbed. She had invited the neighbors, Jake's friends, and my father's synagogue friends, everyone from Levine's office, and all of Aaron's family. His brother had surprised everyone by bringing Lois Rosenzweig, the woman he'd been seeing for 5 years. Rita said he'd never brought her to a family event before. "That's Michael for you. Now that Aaron's got a fiancé, I bet he pops the question any day." Levine was running around with a new camera, asking people to say cheese and driving everyone crazy. But as usual, the pest with the camera turned out to be a hero. He had a terrible time getting my parents to cooperate, but he didn't leave them alone until he got some good shots of them. That picture you put on the cover of your family history paper in 7th grade? That was from Jake's bar mitzvah. When I finally found Betty, she winked and asked if we'd gotten lost. I winked back and said, "What are you doing December 19th? "Why," she said, "am I going to a wedding?" All I had to do was smile, and she threw her arms around me and gave Aaron a kiss and a hug. "Look at me," she said. "I'm becoming a Metzke." Betty said she had to round up the boys before the announcement, and we had to find Mama, too. Betty said she'd never seen Mama in a better mood. She'd been friendly and eaten everything without any complaints, until Betty put out store-bought cherry preserves for tea. Then she made that sourpuss face and said she had to show everyone how much better homemade was. I told Herman to go downstairs and get it, but she said he didn't know where to look. Maybe she got lost like you two. Aaron said he'd get her. She has to get used to me sometime. When everyone was crowded into the living room, Aaron's father shook his finger at me. "I bet I know what this is about," he said, "and here comes the groom." But the groom ran in looking very serious and said, "Somebody call an ambulance." My world got very small. It was a stroke. They took Mama to Beth Israel, the old brick one, which wasn't far from where we lived in Roxbury. They opened the modern building a year later, but it wouldn't have made any difference. There wasn't much they could do for strokes in those days other than keep them warm and massage the muscles. It was hard to know what was happening in the hospital. The doctors didn't tell you anything, and patients were allowed only one visit a day and only one person at a time. When Papa went in, he couldn't say if she seemed better or worse, but he always looked older when he came out. Betty brought clean nightgowns and said the sheets felt like wax paper, but she couldn't tell if Mama was in pain or comfortable or what. "Sometimes she opens her eyes, but I don't know if she sees me." She said her face wasn't as bad as at the beginning, when the right side looked like it had melted off her bones. They only let me go in once. It was pretty awful. The room was overheated and smelled like bleach. My mother's face on the pillow was yellow, and her hair was combed straight back and tucked under her head so I could see the shape of her skull under her skin. Her cheeks were sunken. Her eyelids were twitching. I wasn't sure if she was awake, so I whispered, "Mama, it's me, Addie. How are you feeling? Can I do anything for you?" I tried to sound cheerful, but my stomach was in the same knot as always, waiting for her to wake up and demand to know what I was doing there. Where was my father? Who put her in this place? After a few weeks, she was a little better, opening her eyes and drinking through a straw. She could sit up in bed if someone helped her, and even though she didn't say anything, we were sure she recognized us. The doctor said she might get back some use of her right arm and leg, but that could take months if it happened at all. She could start talking, or maybe not. Like I said, they couldn't do much for her in the hospital, so we took her home. Her right side stayed paralyzed, and the right side of her mouth drooped, so the words were garbled when she started to talk. She got agitated when we didn't understand her, so we knew she was still all there inside her head. During the day, Papa and Betty took turns sitting with her. I came home straight from work and took over while Betty made supper and my father walked to shul. We were the only three she let in the room. Mildred and Rita offered to watch her, but when they came to visit, Mama clamped her mouth shut and refused to open her eyes. If Levine, Aaron, or any of the boys came into the room, she muttered and grimaced until they left. She scared the little ones so much they wouldn't come downstairs at all. My world got very small, the way it always does when someone in your family is sick. I was either at work or at home, where I was either sitting with my mother or helping Betty with the boys. I didn't go out on the weekends either, so Aaron came to the house and taught me to play gin rummy and hearts, and of course we postponed the wedding. My new boss was very sympathetic when I got phone calls at the office. Gussie and Irene stayed in touch, and whenever he could, Aaron met me after work and rode the trolley home with me. He put his arm around me, and there were a few times he had to wake me up when we got to my stop. It was about 2 months after the stroke. Jake's best friend was having his bar mitzvah. Papa had been his teacher, and Betty was friendly with his mother, so I said I'd stay home with Mama, told them to have a nice time and not to hurry back. I hadn't spent much time with her in the mornings. Betty said she usually woke up around 10 o'clock, and that was when she seemed clearer in her mind. It was easier to understand if she tried to talk. But that day, she didn't open her eyes until noon. I offered her soup and tea, but she shook her head and nodded toward the door, which meant she needed the bathroom. She hated the bedpan worse than anything, but she'd lost so much weight since the stroke, it wasn't hard to carry her. She let me wash her face and hands, but she turned away when I offered a cup of tea or bread soaked in broth. I asked if she wanted me to read to her, but she squeezed her eyes shut. I don't know why it's so exhausting to sit with a sick person. It's not like you're doing anything, but it's 100 times more tiring than hard work. Maybe it's the helplessness, or maybe it's the strain of waiting for the body to decide if it's going to get better or not. The sky had been overcast all day, and when it started snowing, the room got dark. I must have dozed off, because the next thing I knew, Mama was sitting up straight, something we didn't think she could do on her own. Her eyes were wide open. She was looking around the room as if she was trying to figure out where she was, like Rip Van Winkle. She frowned at the dirty glasses on the bureau and at the reading lamp I had moved in. In Yiddish, I said, "Mama, can I get you something?" "Do you know who I am, Mama?" She searched my face and frowned. I could hear her breath get faster, and I said, "Don't worry, just rest." Her eyes got big, and she reached out to me with her good arm. I sat down next to her on the bed, and she whispered, "Of course I know my own daughter." Her voice was raspy, and the words were slow, but I could understand her. How can a mother not know her own beautiful daughter? She ran her hand over my hair and let it rest on my cheek. "I didn't know right away it was you, sweetheart, Zisila. Your hair is so short. Have you been sick?" I told her I'd cut my hair and that I was fine and she didn't have to worry. But she was anxious and started talking fast, as if she was in a hurry to say something before she forgot. "I want to tell you that I'm sorry. You were right and I was wrong. If I had listened to you, you would have been happier." She started crying. "Ich bin Moyle. I'm sorry. But you'll forgive me. I know you will. You were always such a good girl. So pretty. So good." I had never heard her apologize to anyone, not even once. I couldn't remember my mother ever looking at me that way, or telling me I was pretty or sweet. She never called me darling. It was like a miracle. All that talking wore her out, and she sank back on the pillows. I kissed her hand and said not to worry about me, that I was getting married to a wonderful man. I asked if she remembered Aaron, and she squeezed my fingers. I said how happy I was to talk to her like this, and that I wished I had tried to explain myself to her before. She shook her head and whispered, "I thought I had lost you, but here you are, just like my mother, your grandmother. You have her golden hands, golden hands, like an angel with a needle and thread. I was wrong to make you go. I chased you and beat you to force you, even when you were telling me you would die if I sent you away. I thought that he would keep you safe and that Bronya would look out for you, but you knew better. You knew this country would kill you. I am sorry, little Sima. My poor, poor Simala." She sighed. Her breath slowed. When she fell asleep, I let it sink in. I had waited my whole life to hear her say those things. That she was sorry. That I was a good girl. And pretty. And sweet. But it was all for Celia. The tenderness, the apology, the love. She didn't even know I was there. I was too sad to cry. It was late when Betty came back from the party. She turned on the light and asked why I was sitting in the dark. Did she sleep all day? I said yes, and that I was going for a walk. I needed some fresh air. It was a beautiful, clear evening. The snow had stopped and the moon had made everything look silver. I was walking a long time before I realized that I was going to Aaron's house. From Roxbury to Brookline is a long way, 5 miles at least, and I turned around a few times. It was so late by the time I got there. His house was dark except for one light in the living room. They never locked the door, so I just walked in. Aaron almost fell out of the chair. I said, "Don't ask. I'll tell you in the morning." "1927. All I felt was pain. My mother died a few weeks later. Levine took care of the funeral the same way he took care of most things, without anyone asking him and without much in the way of thanks. I'd been to the cemetery when Myron and Lenny died, but burying Mama was a completely different experience, like night and day. Even getting there wasn't the same. The roads were better, so we got there in no time, and instead of three mourners, there were 20 people and a whole line of cars behind the hearse. The biggest difference was how normal it seemed. Mama was 65, which wasn't so young in 1927. Nobody was shocked. She had been sick and died at home in her own bed. So it was sad, but nothing like the tragedy it had been with Celia or Myron or Lenny. Only Papa and Levine had been there for Celia's funeral. That was probably because we didn't know many people back then, but maybe it had something to do with how she died. There was so much guilt mixed in with the grief. And how do you explain a healthy young woman dying from a slip of a kitchen knife? With the flu epidemic, everyone was afraid, and walking into a cemetery seemed like tempting fate. I went to the boys' funeral to stand in for Betty, and it's a good thing she didn't come. The idea of seeing those little coffins was so awful. Just remembering it still makes me feel like crying. Before the service for Mama, I went to look at their graves, tried to think of my sister and nephews when they were young and healthy, but all I could remember was the blood on Celia's hands and the look on Betty's face when they took away her little boys. Standing by those gravestones, I didn't get any comfort or what you'd call closure today. All I felt was pain. One thing hadn't changed. The cemetery was just as bleak as I remembered. The trees had grown and they had planted bushes. But it was January and hard to believe that anything would ever be green again. I started to shiver when the service began. There wasn't any wind. Nobody else seemed bothered by the cold, but I could hear my teeth chattering. I had to lock my knees to keep from wobbling. And if Aaron hadn't put his arm around me, I might have keeled over, honest to God. At least Jewish funerals are short. When they lowered the coffin into the ground, I remember thinking, She won't be able to make me feel like there's something wrong with me anymore. But when the first clump of dirt hit the coffin, I realized that I would never stop wanting my mother to tell me that I was all right. And that's when I started to cry. Life is more important than death. After we sat Shiva, Papa told Betty and me that we were official mourners for a whole year, which meant we were supposed to stay away from celebrations and music or entertainment of any kind. So no parties, no going to the symphony, not even a movie. After the first month, Betty stopped paying attention to the rules. If her boys wanted to see the new Our Gang movie, she took them and stayed to watch. You think I'm going to leave them in a dark theater all by themselves? I felt like I was living in the meantime, and I actually didn't mind being quiet. Papa and I ate suppers upstairs with Betty and her family. Then he would go to the synagogue, and I usually went to my room to read. It was sort of like living in the boarding house. Not that I was a hermit. I was with people all day at work, and I kept going to class. I think it was American history that term. My friends called and came to the house. Aaron and I saw each other all the time. We just didn't talk about the wedding. But when the flowers started blooming and everyone put away their winter coats, I started to feel like a dog on a chain. Everywhere I went, I saw couples holding hands and whispering to each other. Aaron showed me an advertisement for an apartment we could afford. I got up my nerve and asked my father how soon we could get married. He said, "Any time you want." I couldn't believe it. You told me I had to wait a year. Did I say anything about weddings? According to the Talmud, if a funeral procession and a wedding procession cross paths, the wedding party goes first. Life is more important than death. You'd think he could have told me that before. "Just don't make it fancy," Papa said. "No music or dancing." That wasn't a problem. I'd always wanted it to be simple, and Aaron didn't care about fancy as long as it was soon. But when I told Betty and Mildred we were thinking about getting married at the beginning of May, which was just a few weeks off, they acted like it was a disaster only a little smaller than the Titanic. Betty said that since she didn't have a daughter, this was going to be her only chance to make a wedding, and why did I want to ruin it for her? For her, right? She and Mildred complained and nudged until we agreed to wait until June so they could make everything nice. Rita asked if she could give me a bridal shower to introduce me to the other women in the family before the wedding. I'd never been to a shower. It was a new fad at the time. But my sister-in-law-to-be had read an article about them in Ladies' Home Journal, and she had her heart set on doing it just like it said in the magazine, right down to pink icing and sugar roses on the cake. She wanted to invite my friends, too, so I gave her Gussie's phone number and said she'd get in touch with everyone else. Rita planned it as a tea party on Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock and told everyone to wear nice dresses and white gloves, if you can imagine. Irene called me to ask if she could come to my party even if she didn't embroider a pillowcase, which Rita had asked all the guests to do. When I said I didn't know anything about pillowcases, she said, "Gussie didn't tell me the pillowcases were supposed to be a surprise. Now I've ruined the whole goddamn thing." The older Irene got, the more she swore. I remember when her grandson pooped in his diaper at his christening, she said, "Holy shit," loud enough for everyone to hear. The look on that priest's face. On the day of the shower, the Metzke house was full of doilies, lilacs, and a dozen aunts and second cousins. After they all got finished hugging me, I smelled like the perfume counter at Jordan's. Rita presented me with a trousseau of pillowcases and towels embroidered with my new initials, and I acted as if Irene hadn't spilled the beans. There were some other surprises, though. I knew Irene and Helen would be there, but I was bowled over when Miss Chevalier and Miss Green walked in with Catherine Walters, who I had lost touch with after I left the transcript. Miss Chevalier kissed my cheek and said, "I'm so happy for you, my dear." Miss Green seemed to have shrunk 2 inches, but she still had a twinkle in her eye. "I like to think we had something to do with your marriage since you met your fiancé in our home." The Ediths hadn't been asked to embroider anything, thank goodness, but Miss Green brought me one of the lovely ceramic boxes she designed, the one you used to put Barbie shoes in when you were little. Having all those women together in one place was like looking through a photo album of my life, from when I was a baby to the Saturday Club, to Rockport Lodge, to working at the newspaper, to meeting Aaron. And it was amazing how well they got along. Miss Green, who had been to Ireland, talked to Irene about the town where she was born. Catherine and Betty had a debate about who was funnier, Harold Lloyd or Buster Keaton. I could have told them it was Charlie Chaplin, but I didn't want to butt in. I asked Helen where Gussie was. "She's just a little late," Helen said. Gussie gave me so much grief if I was even 2 minutes late, I looked forward to giving her a little of her own medicine. When she finally got there, she put up one hand like a stop sign, and then Irene sang, "Ta-da!" and Philomena appeared. I don't know if I shrieked or just stood there with my mouth open, but everyone clapped and Betty shouted, "She didn't have a clue!" As soon as we'd set a date for the wedding, I wrote to Philomena to ask if she could come. She wrote back that she couldn't because that was the week she had promised to take her teacher to a powwow in the mountains, and she couldn't go back on her word or that would be the end of their friendship. I had figured it was a long shot, and I could tell how bad she felt because it was the longest letter I ever got from her. Betty was there when I got her wedding present, which came with a note saying not to open it until the wedding day. They were all in on it, my friends, my sister, even my new in-laws. It might have been the only secret Betty ever kept. She'd rummaged around in my room for Philomena's address. Gussie sent a telegram, and everyone chipped in for the train tickets. It had been more than 10 years since I'd seen my best friend. Philomena still wore a long braid. Her hair wasn't pure black anymore, but the streak of white next to her cheek made her look glamorous, not old. It was the same face, though, darker, a little weathered by the sun, but just as beautiful. She was dressed in a long skirt and a striped shawl like the Indian girls in her picture postcards. There were stacks of turquoise and silver bracelets on both wrists, and she smelled like something fresh and woody. She told me that it was sage, something the Indians used for health and good fortune. I'm making her sound like a cartoon hippie from the 1960s, but she didn't look messy. No matter what she was wearing, Philomena carried herself like a queen. When she saw Miss Green, Philomena took both of her teacher's hands in hers and said, "Thank you for giving me my life." It was such a sweet moment. Catherine said it reminded her of how students in India honored their teachers by touching the ground at their feet. I didn't quite feel up to that, but before the afternoon was over, I thanked Miss Chevalier for everything she had done for me since I was a girl. I wish I'd had a camera. Not that I need pictures to remember that day. I've forgotten a lot more than I like to admit, but I have all the details memorized. The pink icing, Catherine's beautiful yellow shoes, the lilacs, and the sound of Philomena's bracelets when she threw her arms around me, like a wind chime. You never looked at me with anything but love. Sometimes friends grow apart. You tell each other everything, and you're sure this is a person you'll know the rest of your life. But then she stops writing or calling, or you realize she's really not so nice, or she turns into a right-winger. Remember your friend Susie? But sometimes it doesn't matter how far apart you live or how little you talk. It's still there. That was Philomena and me. The day after the wedding shower, we got together in the North End. She had to go to a big family lunch after church, so she wasn't sure exactly what time she'd get away, but I didn't mind waiting. I was sitting on a bench in front of St. Leonard's in the North End on a beautiful day. People were strolling on Hanover Street. Old ladies in black dresses were feeding the pigeons and watching their grandchildren play. It was exactly how I remembered it from when I was growing up, except the hats were different. There isn't enough room to say much on a postcard, so I had 100 questions for Philomena. I knew that some of her New Mexico friends were painters and that she spent a lot of time with an Indian potter named Virginia. I knew she was living by herself and watched the sunset every day. She was selling enough of her pottery to scrape by, but that was about it. It was like I had an empty coloring book for her to fill in. At first, I didn't recognize the frumpy woman in a baggy black dress who was waving at me. Philomena's sisters had made her take off her costume before church and dressed her like a grandmother. They were furious at her. How could she come to Boston for a friend's wedding when she hadn't bothered to make it to her own nieces and nephews' first communions and graduations? They calmed down a little when she told them her friends had paid for her tickets. I guess they forgot she'd been sending them money ever since she moved to Taos, and believe me, she never had much to spare. Philomena unpinned her braid, pulled a woven sash and some bracelets out of her bag, and in 1 minute was back to looking beautiful. She said she was dying for an espresso. I've been dreaming about coffee ever since I got on the train. We went to a cafe where not even the hats had changed. I never saw a person enjoy anything more than Philomena enjoyed that espresso. The waiter must have noticed it too because he brought over a second cup before she could ask. She said grazie, and it was like they were long-lost cousins, talking with their hands and interrupting each other, just like Jews, except everything sounds better in Italian. Philomena had brought a stack of pictures to show me and laid them out on the table in rows, like she was playing solitaire. There were a few of her sitting at a table with Morelli and three couples who were making silly faces at the camera. They had been his friends in art school and shared a big house on the outskirts of Taos. Philomena said we stayed with them at first, but it was like living with the Keystone Cops. They loved each other, but they fought all the time, and I could never figure out who was mad at who. Crazy people, but they were always good to me. Eventually, she and Morelli moved into a cottage on their land. I had always imagined her living in a little shingled house like the ones in Rockport, but the house in the picture looked like a big anthill. Philomena explained what adobe was and how cool her house was on hot days. I said it sounded like living inside of a clay pot. She got a kick out of that. There was a picture of Bob Morelli sitting at a pottery wheel, looking down at a lump of clay between his hands. It made me remember how handsome he was. "That's an old picture," she said. For the first few years, Morelli had gone to New York to visit his son in the summer. But one fall, he didn't come back. He said his son needed him, but Philomena knew that wasn't the only reason. He couldn't work in bronze in New Mexico, and he missed the city. Did I write that he died last year? Car accident. I'm still getting used to the idea. I said I was sorry, and I meant it. I wasn't even mad at Morelli for taking her all the way to New Mexico. Philomena was excited to show me her work, and there were a few vases that reminded me of Miss Green's designs, but most of it had a different shape, round at the bottom, sharper like a tulip bulb, mostly very dark. To me, it looked like streamlined modern art, but it was an old Pueblo style called blackware. She said the minute she laid eyes on it, she had to find out how it was made. She handed me a picture of an Indian woman with wrinkled cheeks and white hair bending over a fire. She said, "This is my teacher, Virginia, my Pueblo Miss Green." Virginia was one of the few people who still made blackware, but when Philomena asked to study with her, she said, "No, the Pueblo people don't have much use for the whites. To them, we're like badly behaved children." But Philomena kept pestering until Virginia let her dig the clay for her pottery and collect the manure she burned in her kiln. Sounded to me like work that slaves did in Egypt, but when I asked if she got paid, she laughed. Virginia thought I should be paying her, and she's probably right. She only started teaching me how to build the pots when she broke her arm. But now that she's getting older, I think she keeps me around because she knows I'll keep the tradition alive. Not that she'd ever say so. Virginia called Philomena's first attempts half-breeds and bastards. But once she stopped smashing them when they came out of the kiln, Philomena knew she was making progress. I'm really getting the hang of it now, but the tourists aren't interested. People want colorful souvenirs that people back home would recognize as Indian, so she was giving art lessons to make ends meet. Of all the mixed nuts, I always thought you'd be the teacher. It turns out I like teaching. Philomena was in Boston for a few weeks before the wedding, and we saw each other a lot. Irene had a dinner party for us with Gussie and Helen, who brought her husband and kids. One evening, Aaron took Philomena and me out for ice cream. She had a lot of family obligations, but we made sure we had time alone and we never ran out of conversation because nothing was too trivial or painful to talk about. I don't know how many times we each said, "I never told anyone, but..." I told her how I wish I'd been more sensitive and sympathetic to poor shell-shocked Ernie, and how I had a dream about trying to save that poor farm girl in Minnesota. I confessed that I was relieved my mother wouldn't be at my wedding, and how sad I was about feeling that way. Somehow, telling Philomena about those things made them seem lighter and less terrible. I remember asking her if that's what it was like after going to confession in church. She said, "God, no. When I was a girl, I thought I'd get in trouble if I didn't say all the Hail Marys and Our Fathers. But nothing bad happened if I didn't say them, and I didn't feel any better when I did. It was like putting a penny into a slot and nothing comes out. By the time I was 12, I only went to church when my sisters made me." She said she felt better talking to someone she could see, someone who cares about her. The time I almost died in that bathtub, what kept me going was the look on your face and Irene's, and that wonderful nurse. I could see how worried you were. Not mad or angry or disappointed, you just didn't want me to die. And afterward, too, you never looked at me with anything but love. No pity, no judgment. I've thought about this a lot, Addie. You made it possible for me to forgive myself. I had no idea it was so important to her, just like she was surprised to find out what I remembered from our conversations that first week at Rockport Lodge. She changed the way I thought about myself. You told me I had a good eye and that I was a good listener. You laughed at my jokes and took my ideas seriously. You know, Ava, it's good to be smart, but kindness is more important. Oh, dear, another old lady chestnut to stitch on a sampler. Or maybe one of those cute little throw pillows. I guess I hadn't written much about the classes I'd taken because Philomena wanted to know about college and my teachers and the subjects I'd studied. When she asked what I was taking in the fall, I said I wasn't planning to sign up. I already felt like an old lady with all the 18 and 19-year-olds, and anyway, once I had children, I wouldn't have the time, and I'd really be too old. It wasn't like today. In those days, you never heard of a married woman going to college. But you'd have thought I'd said I was going to join the circus or enter a convent. Philomena gave me a lecture about women in Taos who started businesses at 50, even 60. She said Virginia's niece was in her 40s when she left her kids with her mother and moved to Albuquerque for 3 years to become a nurse. She said, "You're not even 30 years old, which means you'll be in your 50s when your children are grown up, and you don't have to wait anyway. When they go to school, you can go to school, and you don't even have to move to Albuquerque." I said, "Maybe," but that wasn't enough for Philomena. "Give me one good reason why you shouldn't keep taking classes at least until you have a baby." The reason was that I still didn't know why I was taking classes at all. It would have been different if I wanted to start a business or be a lawyer, but I was still just dabbling, and I wasn't even enjoying it. I had taken literature classes thinking maybe I should be an English teacher like people had been telling me since I was a kid. It was true that I loved reading stories and novels, but the only courses I could take were about Milton or Dryden or Chaucer. They weren't easy to understand, and the professors, they didn't care whether we understood the poems, much less loved them. None of my homework was as interesting as the writers I was reading in the magazines or books I took out of the library. Willa Cather, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis. Philomena said she was going to talk to Aaron about my staying in school. He'll be all for it. You still don't know how smart you are, just like you don't know how pretty you are. But Aaron knows. He also thinks the sun and moon revolve around you. What wouldn't I give to have someone care about me that way? I said, but I thought you didn't want to get married. That has nothing to do with wanting to be loved, she said. I know you never liked Bob and things didn't turn out the way I wanted, but he was the love of my life. The time we spent in Taos was the happiest I've ever been. He found us a studio and made me believe in my talent. We were together day and night. He used to say we were made out of the same clay. Philomena said she was keeping company with someone. He's very nice, but you only get one great love in a lifetime. Then it was my turn to make a speech. Who made that rule, I said, and ticked off the war widows I knew who were happily remarried. Philomena said she wasn't complaining. She liked her independence and privacy, and the fact that nobody judged what she did or didn't do. She admitted that she got lonely for her family and for me. She missed Italian food and good coffee and the smell of the ocean. But I belong to that landscape now, to the sky and the mountains. I wouldn't be happy anywhere else. From the moment Philomena walked into my wedding shower, I had wanted to ask if she was ever coming back to live in Boston. That wasn't the answer I wanted to hear, but I meant it when I said, "Then I'm happy for you." Don't let anyone tell you things aren't better than they used to be. It wasn't a fancy wedding. No long gown or veil, like Betty wanted, but I think I looked pretty great in my tan dress with the pearl beads, and I wore the most beautiful hat I ever owned. There was no music and no dancing the hora, but it was much bigger than I'd imagined, not only because there were so many Metzkes. Between my family, all of my friends, and their families, there were plenty of people on the Baum side, too. Levine held one of the poles for the chuppah. He almost cried when I asked him. Aaron's brother held another, and I don't remember who the other two men were. Never occurred to me to ask Betty or Rita. 58 years ago, asking a woman to do that would have been like asking when a man was going to walk on the moon, something only a crazy person would say. Don't let anyone tell you things aren't better than they used to be. We had lunch in the synagogue because there were too many people to fit into Betty's house. There were long tables with white tablecloths, big platters of herring, rye bread, salads, and pickles, the usual. There was plenty of wine and even a bottle of whiskey with a real label, a wedding present from someone. Since we were in temple, we didn't even have to put in a teapot, so we wouldn't be raided. Prohibition didn't end until 33, which I only remember because it was the year your Aunt Sylvia was born. After we ate, there were toasts and jokes about how Aaron and I met. Philomena stood up and asked us to open her present in front of everyone because there was a story to go with it. Her gift was a big blackware vase with two spouts. "It's called a wedding pitcher," she said. "The two openings stand for the bride and groom, and the handle in between makes them into one. At an Indian wedding, the bride drinks from one side, the groom drinks from the other, and then they're married. If the husband or wife dies, the other one is supposed to give it to a young couple getting married." Sounded sort of Jewish to me. "Anyway, I'm giving mine to the grandchild who gets married first. I don't think you should rush into anything with Brian just to get a nice piece of pottery, but it's something to keep in mind." I wish Levine had taken a picture of me with Aaron and Philomena and the pitcher. He took a dozen of us in front of the wedding cake Mildred had baked, four layers and white frosting. My mother would have called it goyesha, but it was delicious and there wasn't a crumb left over. I noticed my father bringing a slice to an older lady I didn't know. I figured she was with the Metzkes, but it turned out that she was a member of the synagogue. Betty said she was at Mama's shiva, but there's no reason you would remember her. There had been a whole flock of widows at the house after the funeral, and they brought pots of soup and kugel over to the house for weeks afterwards. Betty called them the vultures, which was kind of mean, but kind of true. Whenever an older man lost his wife, there was a competition to get him. Of all the widows, Edna Blaustein had brought strudel as well as casseroles. She was one of the younger ones and kept herself looking nice. She was also the only one with the chutzpah to invite herself to the wedding party. I'm pretty sure that she asked Papa to marry her. Betty thought it was terrible that Papa didn't wait a whole year to marry her. But he said there was no law against it, so they did. And he moved into her house, a triple-decker, gave her a nice little income. It turned out that Edna had expected Papa would take care of the building like her first husband had. But my father didn't know anything about fixing sinks or putting glass in a broken window. After a few years of reading and teaching in shul all day, he wasn't about to shovel coal for the furnace. I almost feel sorry for her, Betty said. Almost. You're that Addie, aren't you? Aaron and I went on a little honeymoon. 3 nights at the Hotel Edward in Rockport, Massachusetts. Our room faced out to the sea, and the full moon on the water was so bright that we had to close the curtains to sleep. It was very beautiful, very romantic. During the day, I showed him everything. We took the train that used to run around Cape Ann. We walked on the beaches and up to the big rocks in Dogtown. We poked around in the art galleries and bought taffy to bring to our nephews. We ate fish every day and ice cream 2 times a day. The cliff house where Philomena and I had met Morelli was gone, washed away in a storm, I guess. All that was left were the granite steps and the slab that used to be in front of the red door. Of course, I took Aaron to see Rockport Lodge. The woman who answered the door didn't want to let us in, but I kept saying that I had been a lodge girl myself and please could we just look around. She finally said I could come into the parlor for a moment, but not Aaron. The house was quiet, so I knew the girls had to be on an outing. There was no good reason to keep him out. We won't be long, I said. It's our honeymoon. It would mean so much to me. I didn't stop talking until she let us both inside, where she didn't let us out of her sight as if we were going to steal something. I don't know what she thought when the first thing I did was head straight to the kitchen. The closet I'd slept in was back to being a pantry, and there was a big new refrigerator and fresh linoleum on the floor. The cook was standing at the door, blowing cigarette smoke through the screen. Mrs. Morse would have thrown her out for sure, but when she turned around, I realized it was her sister, Mrs. Stiles. She was thinner and grayer, but she still had that who-do-you-think-you-are look on her face. I had sent her a letter when I heard Mrs. Morse had died, saying how sorry I was and how I would always remember how good she'd been to me, but I wasn't sure she even got it. Mrs. Stiles said, "I know you. You're that Addie, aren't you?" I was surprised that she remembered my name. "Maggie used to talk about you and what a big fuss you made over her pies. I never understood why she did so much baking when she was here. There's nothing wrong with a plate of stewed fruit. You only have to make it twice a week." I introduced her to Aaron, who said he liked a plate of stewed fruit himself. Mrs. Stiles might have been flattered, but it was hard to tell. A few weeks later, I got a note from Mrs. Stiles with a recipe for pie crust. "My sister would be glad for you to have this. I never bother with it myself. I know you think my pies are the best in the world, but believe me, they're not nearly as good as Mrs. Morse's. Sometimes I wonder if that sister of hers left something out on purpose. Or maybe it's just because I use butter instead of lard. Some of the best years of my life. Your grandpa loved his work. His whole life he tried to make things better for poor children, but his real calling was being a father. It was a talent with him. As soon as our girls could sit up, he was wheeling them to the library and taking out books to read them bedtime stories. I used to listen, too. It was the first time I'd ever heard some of those fairy tales, and I was surprised at how scary some of them were. Your mother didn't sleep for a week after Rumpelstiltskin. We liked the Little House on the Prairie book so much that he would run to the bookstore whenever there was a new one, and we'd stay up late to find out what was going on with the Ingalls family. Aaron was heartbroken when Auntie Sylvia and your mom were old enough to read on their own and fired him. When your sister and you were born, it was as if he'd been holding his breath for all those years. Sometimes we'd drive to your house and stay just 20 minutes so he could read you a story. He had most of Dr. Seuss memorized. Do you remember how you jumped all over him for Hop on Pop? We were the only ones on either side of the family to have daughters, and the aunts went overboard. Betty bought every doll she ever saw, and Rita, who had two boys, kept our girls in pink until they were in high school. Grandma Mildred taught them how to bake bread, took them to the flower show every spring, and bought them corsages. It was like we were in that fairy tale where all the fairy godmothers bring gifts to the princess. Gussie bought savings bonds for every birthday. Helen, who was the best-dressed woman I ever knew, gave us her daughter's beautiful hand-me-downs. Miss Chevalier gave them books, and Catherine Walters bought them each a new diary every year. When Betty found out we had asked a neighborhood girl to babysit, she read me the riot act. That was her job. When I was pregnant, I was petrified about being a good mother. I would lie awake at night and worry about all the mistakes I was going to make, dropping, yelling, nagging, even poisoning. It took me a few years to get the hang of cooking. It's a good thing babies don't give you a lot of time to think. You fall in love with them, and when you realize how much they love you back, life is very simple. Of course, I was fascinated by every sneeze and yawn, and when my babies started to talk, I was sure they were geniuses, and your grandfather and their aunties agreed. I remember Irene saying everyone thinks their children are geniuses until they go to kindergarten. I was a little offended by that, until I saw that two other children in the class had started to read 3 months before mine did. Being a mother wasn't as scary as I thought it would be, not only because Aaron was a good father, but because I didn't have to invent the wheel. I learned from Betty that it was good for children to have fun with them, get on the floor and play. And I watched the way Irene talked to her son and daughter, almost as if they were grown-ups. There was no baby talk, no beating around the bush in her house. Irene always told the truth and called a spade and a penis. That was unheard of in the 30s. When her little boy Milo said penis at a family dinner, it was as if he'd murdered the Pope. When Irene's kids were both in school, she got a job as the office manager for the Birth Control League of Massachusetts. She didn't keep it a secret from Joe's family either. They were horrified, tried to get him to make her quit. But Joe knew better than anybody that there was no way to make Irene do anything. And he loved her for it. Irene and Joe, Aaron and I were a foursome. We spent so much time together, our kids were like cousins. When Joe lost his job in the Depression, it didn't feel so much like charity when we had them over for supper twice a week. Not that we didn't feel it, too. We ate a lot of beans, and I remember putting newspaper in a pair of shoes to get another summer's use out of them. But compared to most people, we had an easy time. Aaron didn't lose his job, but what made the biggest difference was that Levine moved us into one of his buildings in Brookline and wouldn't let us pay rent. You'll mow the lawn, he said. The lawn in front of that triple-decker was so small you could cut it with a pair of scissors. But that was my brother-in-law. He was a know-it-all his whole life. If you asked Levine what time it was, he'd give you a lecture about how his watch was the best one on the market and only a nudnik would buy anything else. But I don't think he ever evicted a single tenant from the buildings he owned. It's strange to say, but I had some of the best years of my life during the Depression because that was when I had your mother and aunt. They were nothing like their namesakes. Your mother, Clara, was the opposite of Celia. Clara was a spitfire who started talking at 7 months, and once she started walking, I never sat down. Your Aunt Sylvia was nothing like Aaron's birth mother, Simone, who was famous for her sense of humor and for starting the Metzky hug. My Sylvia didn't say a word until she could talk in sentences and always took things to heart too much, but she was the kindest, most loyal person you ever met. So much of who a person is has to do with temperament. I think my sister Celia was probably born without any defenses, like Betty was born with skin like a rhinoceros. I'm somewhere in between. It helped that I was born in America and that I got to go to school, but there was something built into my makeup, too. Something that let me connect to the friends and teachers who helped along the way. I think my girls inherited that from me. They both did well in school, too. Your mother was the valedictorian at Northeastern. You didn't know? That's terrible. You should do an interview with her next. Or maybe it would be better to wait until you're a little older when you're completely cooled off from adolescence. Oh, yes, your mother and I butted heads when she was in high school. I didn't like her friends, a bunch of rich girls who treated her like a pet dog and started her smoking cigarettes. She thought I was telling her how to live her life and treating her like a 5-year-old. We were both right, but it took until she was out of college for us to admit it. Old friends are the best. The year both of the girls were in school, I decided I would take some daytime classes. Aaron picked up the Simmons catalog and asked if I'd be interested in social work practice with delinquent youth. I'm sure he would have taken that class if he could. But after years of listening to Aaron's stories from work at the Child Welfare League, it sounded interesting to me, too. I'd never given social work a thought because those classes were held all the way downtown. But Aaron said, so what? The trolley went downtown, too, and we could have lunch together, just the two of us. So I signed up, and that was that. The minute the teacher opened her mouth, I knew what I was supposed to do. Anne Feingold was one of those people who lights up a room. You wouldn't think so to look at her. She was in her 40s, 5 feet tall, plump, frizzy-haired, and brilliant. She told us that social work was a young profession still finding itself. She called it a creative science and said that in her opinion, the best social workers were intelligent and compassionate, and while she could give us ideas and tools to help our fellow man, she couldn't teach us how to put ourselves into another person's shoes. She said, if you don't already know how to do that, you should drop this class and consider another line of work. She reminded me of Irene, no bullshit. She made me think of my Shakespeare teacher, too, because he was so passionate about his subject and curious about us. Anne insisted that everyone use first names in class, which was unheard of back then. I took every class she taught. We got to be good friends, and the husbands, too. You probably don't remember, but they were at your bat mitzvah. When I had to do my field work, Anne sent me to Beth Israel, where I did intake interviews with women who were waiting in the emergency room. I was given a list of questions to ask: age, where they were born, years of schooling, marital status, reason for coming to the hospital. There was one woman, She was my age, but looked 20 years older, who answered everything in a flat, quiet voice. When I asked how many children she had, she stopped and gave me a hard look. Then, as if she was admitting to something terrible, she whispered, 3 living children, but 6 times pregnant. It was all I could do to keep from throwing my arms around her and telling her that I had 2 living children, but I'd been pregnant 4 times. I had 2 miscarriages before your mother was born, and I was sure it had been my fault. I'd eaten the wrong thing, or ridden on a bumpy streetcar, or maybe I shouldn't have gone to see that scary movie, or else it was a sign I shouldn't have children because I wasn't fit to be a mother. I didn't talk to anyone about how brokenhearted I was or how hopeless I felt. I had no idea how common it was to lose a pregnancy. Betty came to see me in the hospital after I lost the second one. She noticed I hadn't touched the cookies she brought the day before. I said I didn't feel like eating. But instead of her usual nudging, she sat down next to me on the bed and told me that she had lost a baby, too. It was after you got married. We really did want a little girl. I said, why didn't you tell me? She said, I don't know. Women used to think we were supposed to act as if nothing had happened, as if losing a baby you wanted wasn't a big deal. And if you did say something, people told you that you'd forget all about it when you had a healthy baby. I wanted to punch them all in the face. Betty cried. I cried. We had never been closer. After those interviews in the emergency room, I never did another intake without asking a woman how many pregnancies she'd had. And just asking the question like that opened a door nobody had noticed was there. I heard about abortions and unwed girls whose fathers and mothers beat them or threw them downstairs so they would miscarry. I heard from women who had miscarried without knowing what was happening to them and then nearly died from infections. A lot of them said they'd never told their story to anyone before, and most of them thought what happened to them was their own fault. When I told Anne what I was hearing, she said I had the makings of a book. I think I laughed at her. I was raising children and had a hard time getting my reading done and my papers written, much less a book. But I never forgot the idea. When the girls were in high school, I started working on my master's degree. I interviewed more than 200 women by the time I was done. I didn't just ask about their pregnancies, but about how they had learned about sex and their first sexual experience. I couldn't believe how many of them knew nothing on their wedding nights, or worse, how many had been raped. There were days I went home shaking, and Aaron would hold me until I calmed down. After all his years in child welfare, he wasn't surprised by anything. I talked about what I was learning with my Saturday Club friends, too. We always stayed close, but during World War II, we really held each other together. Irene lost her nephew in the Pacific. Helen's son was wounded in England. And our own Jake was killed over Italy. He was a pilot, a hero. We all did whatever we could to get Betty and Levine through the shock, but they didn't really come back to life until their first grandchild was born. Eddie named him Jonah Jacob, after his brother. All those years, Philomena kept sending postcards, and once in a while I'd get an envelope with a sketch or a picture of what she was working on. As soon as it wasn't ridiculously expensive, we called each other long distance once a month at least. Old friends are the best, and I dedicated my book to them. It took me almost 20 years to finish. Unasked Questions came out the same year as The Feminine Mystique. Gussie was outraged that my book got lost in all the hoopla about Betty Friedan. That woman stole your thunder. I told her not to be silly. I wrote my book for social workers. It was never going to be a bestseller. But it was a success in its own way. It got me the teaching job at Boston University. I got a lot of letters from women thanking me for writing it. I can't tell you how much those meant to me. I still miss him like crazy. Your grandfather and I went to New Mexico twice. The first time was when the girls were 12 and 14. It was our first big family trip. We went horseback riding and hiking, and Philomena took us to the Pueblo village where her teacher lived. Virginia was pretty frail by then, but she lit up when she saw Philomena. We were all invited inside to eat. One night, Philomena kept the girls at her place for a sleepover. They camped outside, and she woke them up in the middle of the night to watch a meteor shower. Your mother and your Aunt Sylvia didn't stop talking about it all the way back on the train. Aaron and I made a second trip when the girls were in college. It was just the two of us that time. We got a sleeper car and drank wine in the dining car. It was like a second honeymoon. We stayed with Philomena, who was living in a big house with her husband. I bet you weren't expecting that. She got married when she was almost 60 and always said she was more surprised than anyone. Saul Cohen was an art collector from Philadelphia who fell in love with Philomena's pottery on a visit to Taos and bought everything she had to sell. 4 weeks after they met, I got a telegram that started, "Sit down." It's in the box with all her postcards. They lived in Taos most of the year, but Saul came back east a lot to see his children and grandchildren. Philomena came with him, so I got to see her pretty often. She was here for Miss Green's funeral and for the 50th reunion of all the Saturday Club girls. When Aaron died, she flew from New Mexico for the funeral, stayed with me for a whole month. I still miss him like crazy. You should only have my luck in that department. Not that he was perfect. Your grandpa snored like a buzzsaw, and I never saw him eat a piece of fresh fruit. How can you not like apples or watermelon or even raspberries? It drove me nuts. And I'm sure I drove him nuts hawking him about it. As he got older, Aaron got set in his ways about a lot of things. He hated television, wouldn't even watch PBS with me. To him, all popular music written after 1945 was garbage, and he thought I was only pretending to like the Beatles so my students would think I was cool. But he did like trying new things, bread baking, guitar lessons, fishing. When we started renting the cottage in Gloucester, he read everything he could find about Cape Ann and asked the old Sicilians at the coffee shop on Main Street for stories. They adopted him and taught him how to swear in Italian and drink Sambuca. But after he found out they were going to vote for Ronald Reagan, he took his newspaper to Dunkin' Donuts and never talked to them again. He hated Reagan. I always thought that election had something to do with his getting sick. Your grandfather was a peach. If he'd been at my birthday party, he would have made a speech so schmaltzy there wouldn't have been a dry eye in the house. It's a shame he wasn't there, but it's worse that he missed being at your sister's wedding and at your graduation from Harvard. He would have been so proud. Harvard. Like I said, I miss him like crazy, but life goes on. Now there's something to look forward to. My birthday party was wonderful, wasn't it? So many people. The family, colleagues from Simmons and BU, my graduate students, and my friends. Irene turns 85 next month, and Gussie with her walker but still going strong. Of course, I thought about everyone who wasn't there, too. Miss Chevalier, Helen, Catherine, Betty, and her Herman. Philomena felt bad that she couldn't make it, but her hip didn't heal fast enough for her to travel. I'm thinking about flying out to see her. Don't tell your mother, okay? She worries about me taking trips alone. course, I'd much rather be going with your grandfather. But maybe you'd like to come with me? Such a beautiful part of the country, and you've never been. You're not going to have time for a real vacation once school starts, and it would be my treat, just you and me. As much as your Brian loves me, he's not going to want to go on vacation with his grandmother-in-law. If you get married, that is. Oh, no. Maybe I am becoming a Yenta after all. But think about it anyway, huh? It was a little uncomfortable, all those birthday speeches about what an amazing human being I am. But hearing your mother and aunt say how lucky they are to have me as their mother, that's a level of nachas everyone should know. Still, I have to tell you, it was a little like being at my own funeral. Which reminds me, I want you to make sure there is just as much joking and laughing when I die. You were the funniest of all. I can't believe you told them that we smoked pot on my 80th birthday. Maybe you'll put that in when you do the eulogy. And please, you do it. It would be too hard for your mother or your aunt, and it's always so moving when a grandchild speaks. Don't look at me that way. I'm fine. The doctor says she only hopes she's as healthy as me when she's 85. And anyway, there's no way I'm dying before I get to hear someone call you Rabbi Ava Miller. I keep trying to imagine what my father would say about his great-granddaughter becoming a rabbi. I think his head would explode. Rabbinical school is 5 years, right? So I'll be 90 when you graduate. Oh, excuse me, when you're ordained. Now there's something to look forward to.
The Boston Girl was written by Anita Diamond and read by Linda Lavin. It was recorded by Erica Weintraub and Jared O'Connor. Editing and post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. The Boston Girl was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Boston Girl is available in print from Scribner. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Day After Night, written by Anita Diamond and read by Dagmara Dominich.